Everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani on IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network, and I'm so happy to be here with all of you today. I have a great show planned. I have Dana Gunders as my guest today. She is the staff scientist at the Natural Resources Defense Council, and she wrote a great book called The Kitchen Waste Handbook, and I'm inviting her on to talk to us about that. But first, I want to share some things going on in and around the city, and of course, I want to share a recipe with you this week. So first, I want to just say this week, on Monday evening, I went to Long Beach to participate in a public hearing for the Port Ambrose project that is being proposed to be built off the coast of Long Beach. It is a natural gas, a liquefied natural gas facility that is going to be sitting there out in the middle of the Atlantic, you know, not only a target, but it's going to be a site for exporting fracked gas. And as you know, Governor Cuomo has made fracking illegal and banned it here in New York State, yet we're still trucking in, piping in fracked gas from all over. And it's really a dangerous proposition, having all that out in the middle of the Atlantic, so close to not just Long Beach, but so close to Manhattan and New Jersey, is really just horrible. I also found out that it's on top of a fault line, and it is not going to even reduce prices. You know, some people were saying, oh, well, we need to bring the energy costs down. And the reality is, of this project, the energy costs don't even go down, because all this fracked gas is really for export. Importing any fracked gas or any gas to this facility will not happen, because right now the gas in this country is cheaper than anywhere else. So importing it, it's not going to be happening. It's really for export. And it's just a bad, bad decision for the environment, for people's health, all the way around. So please let your voices be heard. Any opportunity you have to call the governor, sign a petition, whatever you can do to help keep this from happening would be really, really great. Also, I should mention that it is in the same location as a proposed wind farm that we really would love to see built. That's really a sustainable, renewable energy source, and that's the direction that we need to go in. And it would be really to Governor Cuomo's benefit to support that. I know he claims to want to look at climate issues as a real issue and to keep New York green and clean. And so supporting the wind farm would certainly do that, and vetoing this liquefied gas facility would also do that. So I hope he does that. Right now we are in the midst of Restaurant Week in Long Island. I don't know if any of you have taken advantage of it, but it's always a nice opportunity to see what restaurants are out there and experiment and try some out. Also, there's a new museum that just opened. It's the Museum of Food and Drink in Williamsburg, of all places, one should figure. And it is, there's starting with a great exhibition called At Flavor, Making It and Faking It. learning about what natural and artificial really means, and learning about the discovery of, you know, when they first started doing flavor simulation with vanilla and seaweed, and how that whole $25 billion industry got started. So that's the first exhibit going on there. I have not been yet. I'm looking forward to going. But I think all of you should check it out. Museum of Food and Drink in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. November 5th, Edible Escape is happening in Brooklyn in various sites. You can go into the Edible website to find out more about it. There's also a great beer expo going on. Starfish Junction Productions is putting it on at Belmont Racetrack. And that's November 7th. November 8th is the Naval Expo on Long Island. Just Google Naval Expo and you can find out all the information about that. But that's always a really wonderful event, focusing on well-being, great natural products, beauty products, as well as lots of great speakers. So check out the Naval Expo going on this weekend. November 12th is the Capital Food Fight. That's down in D.C., but that's a fun event. 75 of D.C.'s best restaurants compete live on stage in a battle for the best culinary recipes. So that's a fun thing. November 12th, there's a screening out here at the Sustainable Institute at Molloy College, a screening of Deep Green. Whenever this college puts on these screenings, it's free, but there's a suggested $5 donation, and it includes a vegan dinner. And it's always a really nice time. So I have not seen Deep Green before, but usually the films that they screen there are really great. So I'd recommend checking that out. November 14th is a Farm to School conference going on in Asheville, North Carolina. All of these events you can find on my website. And there will be links to the actual sites for more information as well. I am also gearing up for this year's 21st annual Thanksgiving feast. Every year for the past 21 years, I've been partnering with the River Fund New York Food Pantry in creating a Thanksgiving feast for those that are less fortunate in our area. And it takes place at Rufus King Park, but all weekend long, people are coming out to the IE Green Homestead and cooking here. I have over 100 people that will rotate through my place over the weekend, cooking turkeys, washing hundreds of pounds of potatoes in my bathtubs, scrubbing, slicing, dicing, everything that has to happen to go into creating a really wonderful Thanksgiving homemade feast for those that are less fortunate than many of us. And it's a great, great event. The energy is very high. People really come together, work together. I have parents coming with their kids. It's always great. And on my website, there is a sign up, a doodle document. If you want to participate, if you want to come and get a group of people together, I ask everybody to donate $25 towards the food. If you can swing it, if you can't, you can't. And just come and put your great energy out. But either way, we'd love to have your participation there. It's always a wonderful, wonderful thing. The North Shore Land Alliance is having another Walk in the Woods on November 22nd, and that's in the Preserve in Cold Spring Harbor. You can go to their website or, again, onto my website to learn more about it. November 30th, The Art of Fermentation, an evening with Sander Katz. Sander's a great, great person who has been really introducing fermented foods to people on a large scale. And he was a guest on my radio show last year. He's really wonderful. And if you can make it, I really recommend checking that out. Where is it taking place? It's taking place on 47th Street in Manhattan from 6:30 to 9, and it's being organized by Just Food. So save the date for that, November 30th. And there's lots more events. I don't want to take the time right now to go through it, but I recommend going onto my website and checking out all the events and always check my calendar. It's always a wonderful source to finding wonderful things to do in the New York and out of New York area as well. I want to share a recipe with you. One of my clients is on a completely fat-free diet. You know, I guess both his father, his grandfather, they have had heart disease in the family, and he has a condition where any fat can build up in his arteries. So he's really on a very fat-free diet, including no nuts, no avocados. So I'm working on some of my recipes and recalculating them to make them fat-free. And this is a Linzer tart that I have made for years. It's a wonderful vegan, he's also vegan, I should mention, a wonderful vegan recipe. And I substituted out applesauce for the fat, and I added more oats and whole wheat pastry flour and took out the nuts. So get ready for this recipe. They're really quite good. I am shocked that they came out as good as they did. And so let me know. I always love feedback. So I started with 1.5 cups of oats that I ground, and you want to measure it after you grind it up. So you want 1.5 cups of ground oats, and I leave it a little chunky. I don't completely puree it so it's so smooth like flour. I like a little bit of oat in the flour. I also use 1.5 cups of whole wheat pastry flour, 1/4 teaspoon of cinnamon, and you can do a little bit more cinnamon. I think the next time I might even try 1/2 teaspoon of cinnamon, 1 pinch of salt, 2/3 cup of maple syrup, 1/2 cup of applesauce. And then for the filling, I usually use a jar of raspberry preserves or apricot preserves. And that's what I did, raspberry and apricot. You could also do blueberry or any jam that you like. And so it's very easy. You're going to combine all the ingredients into a large mixing bowl, except for the jam. And, you know, mix it up really well so that all of the flour is wet from the maple syrup and the applesauce. And then you're going to make them into about 1-inch size balls. And in order to do this and not have it stick to your hand, wet your hands and then shake the water off so that your hands are still a little damp, and you're going to have to keep redoing that throughout the process of making these cookies. And so you're going to make the cookies round balls and then flatten them in your hand and you know, so that they're a flat disc, and use your hand to smooth the edges of the cookie so that they're not cracking and breaking. And then just place the disc down onto the cookie sheet and continue doing that until you finish up all the cookies. And then with one of your fingers, your thumb or your index finger, again, a little moist or a little wet, you're going to make an indentation for the jam. And so you make a little indentation on the cookies and then fill it with the jam. And you're going to bake it at 350 for 10 minutes, and then you're going to turn the pan around and cook it for another 10 minutes. And that's it. Really easy to make, very delicious, really beautiful. So enjoy. And of course, I love feedback. So if you do make them, let me know how you like them. Okay. And now it's my pleasure to introduce my guest. Dana Gunders is a staff scientist at the Natural Resource Defense Council, and she focuses on food and agriculture. She works on market and policy-oriented initiatives to promote sustainability throughout the food systems and the supply chains. She leads NRDC's work in reducing food waste and is the author of a widely distributed report called Wasted: How America is Losing Up to 40% of Its Food from Farm to Fork to Landfill. She also recently co-authored a report called The Dating Game, revealing how confusing food dates lead to food waste in America. Her work on food waste has been featured in CNN, NBC, The New York Times, Wall Street Journal, NPR, and now PRN. Her new book is called The Kitchen Waste Handbook, and it's my pleasure to introduce to all of you Dana Gunders. Dana, you with me?
I am.
Great. Thank you so much for joining me.
Sure, glad to be here.
Great. So I think, you know, most people don't realize at all how much food waste really adds up. And according to your organization's 2012 analysis, they say that 40% of all the food in the U.S. is being wasted. Can you, is that really true? And can you share with us how most of the food is wasted?
Sure, it is true. And I think it's shocking for the reason you mentioned that we don't see it. You know, you don't see huge quantities being thrown out. You see just half a sandwich, quarter of a sandwich here and there, the lettuce that went bad in your fridge, the potatoes on a breakfast platter. But farm to fork, it does all add up to about 40% of all the food in this country never getting eaten. It's happening for so many different reasons. On our farms, it's happening because we're really picky about the aesthetics of our food. So a lot of food that doesn't come out kind of perfectly straight or perfectly colored never actually makes it off the farm. It happens in grocery stores because they have to carry so much inventory so that we can walk in at any time of day and get exactly what we want. And they also try to make it look very appealing, which sometimes leads to large displays of food, and some of that never gets sold. And then, you know, in our homes, it's everything from cooking too much food, storing it improperly, just having busy lives and never getting around to eating the things that we shopped for, and other, you know, some misunderstanding of expiration dates on food and other reasons. So yeah, it's really all over the place.
You know, you had a great analogy in your book. It's like walking out of the supermarket with five full bags of groceries, dropping two bags in the parking lot and just leaving them there. That's what 40% looks like. And that's huge. Huge. And I can't even imagine how much money each family must waste, you know, on a monthly basis, just in that food waste.
Yeah, well, it's huge. I mean, as an economy, it's about $162 billion worth of food that's going to waste. And for the average American, you know, household of four, it winds up being about $1,400 worth of food.
$1,400, that's more money than some families have to buy food all year.
It's true. I mean, it's a lot. And it's, you know, we don't, like I said, we're so price sensitive when we're in the store. You know, 10 cents can sway us one way or another. But somehow once we get that food home, we're no longer calculating how much it cost us. And so we don't really realize how much it's actually costing us to throw that food out.
Mm-hmm. Now, in your book, you talk about ways that people can save money and reduce waste when grocery shopping. Can you share some of those tips with us?
Sure. Well, grocery shopping is a really important moment around food waste because it's really where we commit, where we make our commitment to the food. And so being careful with our shopping is important to being successful and not wasting too much. So the easiest thing I can recommend is that before you go to the checkout counter, just to turn around and take a look in your cart and try to identify when during the week ahead you'll actually get around to eating what you have in there. And if you can't think of a time that week, then maybe it's not the right week to buy that food. So that, I think, is like the shortcut method. The more extensive method at Amlitite, what really seems to work is old school thinking, but it still works. And that is around really planning your meals and using a shopping list. And that, again, it doesn't have to be like a 2-hour process on Sunday where you sit down and plan your meals for the week. I think it can be fairly shorthand. It can be the food that you always like to eat. It doesn't have to mean inventing new meals, but just sort of identifying, you know, what you'll eat that week and looking in your pantry before you leave to see what you already have, and then going to the store with a list and trying to stick to that list. That actually can result in a lot less waste.
Mm-hmm. And you're mostly talking about fresh produce and fresh meats and vegetables, that kind of thing, right? Not so much the canned stuff. Or are you also concerned with the canned goods?
Well, certainly perishable foods go to waste much more than canned foods. I think what happens with canned foods is, for instance, you have a jar of pasta sauce. You open it, you use half of it, And then you stick the other half in the fridge, but you don't really feel like pasta again for a while. And next thing you know,
right.
the pasta sauce has gone bad.
Right. Right. So what are some of the helpful tips you have for people for actually planning the meals?
Well, I think one thing to keep in mind is your schedule and the reality of what you tend to eat. So I think a lot of people are very ambitious and aspirational when they're in the store and they want to eat healthy and they want to cook. And so they buy all this food, but then the week happens and life happens. And by Wednesday, you're getting home at 7 p.m. and you're tired and your kids are doing what they're doing. And all of a sudden you're throwing frozen pizzas in the oven or ordering takeout. So I like to suggest that people plan in a few lazy nights, because for most of us, they do tend to happen. And also to think double duty. And so when you're buying an ingredient, you know, if you really want to make a particular chicken dish that week, to think about what that you're buying, you know, you might have extra, and then plan another meal around those same ingredients.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah, you have great tips on how to use up leftovers, and how to create a new meal. Because I know a lot of people, and I find this funny because in my family, people love leftovers, but lots of people don't like leftovers. They want to feel like they're eating something new each time. And I know when I was the chef at the cafeteria at our local Waldorf school, one of my biggest challenges and one of the things actually I found most fun for me, because it was really pushed my creative juices, was figuring out a new dish to make with the leftovers. And you have some tips for people. You want to share some of those?
Yeah, well, I totally agree. I think some people are leftover people and some people just aren't. I like to come up with some dishes that are kind of standard, but you can throw anything into. So pasta salad, for instance. You can really throw anything in a pasta salad. And sometimes even if you have, you know, a leftover dish, if you mix it with pasta, that actually creates a whole new one. Tacos are another thing. You know, tacos don't have to be just Mexican food. There's all restaurants these days that are coming up with really creative tacos. So I always keep tortillas in my fridge so I can kind of make world's tacos out of whatever we have left over. Uh-huh.
I do that with nori rolls too. I always have sheets of nori, and it's amazing what you can roll inside of a seaweed and create a new vegetarian sushi dish.
Mm-hmm. I like that.
Yeah, that's always fun too. But yeah, rolling things up are really great, you know, any kind of tortillas, burritos, that kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, in your book, you also talk a lot about the safety of food and the misconception people have about expiration dates. Like the minute an expiration date happens, people are just throwing it out. Can you explain to people what the dates really actually mean and whether or not they really do have to throw things out?
Sure. Yeah, there is sort of massive confusion out there around expiration dates. Many people think that the dates on food are telling them to throw the food out because it's bad or unsafe. But actually, the dates really came out of a demand for freshness and information on freshness, and they are meant to indicate when the product is at its best quality until. But often can be eaten days, weeks, even months after that date. And they're not federally regulated. They're very kind of haphazardly regulated at the state level. And really, for the most part, they're just the manufacturer's best guess at when the product is at its freshest.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I know also, I was working for a client and I was shocked one day. I come in and she's having her housekeeper throw out all of the spices in her spice that are past an expiration date. I didn't even know spices had an expiration date. But since I'm a chef that cooks by tasting, you know, if something doesn't have, if I'm adding curry and I don't taste enough curry, I add more, you know? So what happens, you know, with, with spices, for instance, they just become not as full flavored. And so you know, instead of 1 teaspoon, you might use 1.5 teaspoons, but it's still, you know, it certainly doesn't go bad. They're already dried. And so she was throwing all these spices out, and I brought them all home. I was like, you can't just throw these out, you know, not to mention the glass jars they were in or the plastic jar. They were just going to all go into the garbage. And I found good homes for them. But yeah, something like that, they don't really go bad.
They don't. And I think that brings up an important point. And that is that, you know, what makes us, when people get sick from food or they get food poisoning, that really happens because food is contaminated, not because it's old. And so when we talk about food going bad, you know, that's food going through its natural process of aging. It's not actually, and our bodies are very well equipped to know when not to eat food because it's old. You know, if it smells bad to us, if it looks bad, we probably shouldn't eat it. But that's not because it's going to give us food poisoning, such as like E. coli or salmonella, but really that it wouldn't settle well in our stomachs. In things like E. coli or salmonella, when we get food poisoning, that's contamination that happens at the farm or in the processing plant, and it's sort of present whether the food is old or not. And I tell you all that because I think a lot of times people will look at milk, for instance, and they'll see it's past its date, and it'll smell fine and it'll taste fine, but there's kind of this fear that it's going to make them sick, and therefore they throw it out. And really, that's not something they need to do, particularly with a product like milk where it's pasteurized, and it's actually quite safe to drink it well past the date.
Uh-huh. You even say that you can, that even if the milk is curdled or sour, it's still safe to consume.
I do, yeah. So, I mean, you wouldn't want to drink milk that sort of smells awful to you because you'd probably have some kind of gag reflex. But you can cook with it. And in my book, there's actually a recipe for sour milk pancakes, which when I first was writing the book and the recipes were getting professionally tested, the woman who was testing them thought I was crazy. And I had to go back and prove to her that not only was it safe, but actually that they came out really well. And it's amazing to me that the milk can be quite sour. I pushed it pretty far. And the pancakes, they don't taste bitter or anything. They're really quite delicious.
So is it like a sour cream then?
Well, it's similar. I guess it's a little bit similar to buttermilk. But when you make buttermilk, you do that with raw milk that's not pasteurized. So it's a different process of souring than you would get from that. Different bacteria involved, but nevertheless, it seems to have a similar effect in the cooking.
Uh-huh. What are some other examples of food products that you would say are safe to eat after they look like they've gone bad?
Yeah, well, I would say, and actually in the book, we have a chart that talks about what characteristics are generally harmless and which are better to steer clear of. And falling in the generally harmless category are things like scars, bruises, you know, lettuce when it gets kind of yellow or brown at the tip, things like that. Mold is something you pretty much want to stay away from because it can have roots that grow into your food even beyond where you see the mold. So the suggestion around mold is that only if you can cut a full half inch off of the food should you eat that food.
Uh-huh. Although cheese, they say you can cut just the edge of the cheese off where there's mold.
Yeah, the harder the cheese, the less you have to worry about getting that stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I know many of us are guilty of stocking up on fresh produce. And then, you know, finding it wilted and unused in the refrigerator a week later. Is there any recommendations you have for what to do with these vegetables to salvage them?
Yeah, there's some neat little tricks. One of the easiest, particularly when products are wilted, like lettuce or carrots or broccoli, sometimes it gets a little bendy. If you just soak them in ice water for 5 to 10 minutes, it'll actually perk them right back up. It's kind of a neat little experiment, and it works really well. So that's one thing. For things like tortilla chips or bread, you can toast them. Even if you have quite stale tortilla chips, if you toast them, the oils in it will kind of, I don't know, re-crisp the tortilla chips. It's pretty neat.
Yeah, I know that is good with crackers, too. If the crackers are stale and have lost their crisp, or even mm-hmm. cookies, you can re-toast them a little bit.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Another thing that I do a lot is, you know, if I have things going bad, I'll make a big pot of stock, you know, just, take any of the vegetables that are looking old, and just make a good vegetable stock that I can store in my freezer and be able to just grab whenever I need a vegetable stock.
Yeah, absolutely. Soup is a great way to handle, those products that are almost bad. And sometimes you want to make a stock, and sometimes you can actually just use the vegetables in a full soup. I have a couple other tricks that I use a lot. Like, I make frittatas, because you can pretty much take any vegetable, and throw a little cheese in there, or meat if you eat meat, and have some around, and pop a good frittata out, and it feels like you're eating this fairly fancy meal for dinner.
Right, right. For those that don't know, frittata is, you know, like a baked omelet almost. You know, I do it right in the cast iron pan. You stick it right in the oven, you pull that out, and you serve right out of the cast iron pan. It's also a beautiful presentation, so it's really nice. So what are some of the most useful tips in ways to actually store food to make it last longer in the refrigerator?
Sure. Well, you know, each food seems to have its own specific way it likes to be stored. And for that reason, in the book, I actually included a whole reference section where you can look up strawberries or artichokes or fish and learn, you know, what the best way to store it really is and whether or not it can be frozen and how to use up little pieces and parts. But I would say some general principles are to use clear containers. I know in my household where I grew up, my mom would always take yogurt containers and put leftovers in there, and then inevitably...
Oh, that's the worst, right?
Yeah.
You open the top and there's this green fluff exactly. mold growing on the top of the container.
There's something as simple as using clear, see-through containers just so that you can be reminded of what's in things actually makes quite a bit of difference. Most products do better when they are sealed from the air. You know, they're in some kind of airtight container because that reduces the amount of oxygen exposure that they're getting. Although some products need something more breathable. So one thing to note is that, you know, a lot of us have those crisper drawers in the bottom of our refrigerator, and we just stuff vegetables in there. We don't really necessarily know how to use them. So what those drawers actually do is create a different humidity zone in the refrigerator and a little bit of a different temperature that is better for vegetables. And the way that I recommend using them is to take one, and if your refrigerator has a setting to sort of vegetables or fruits or high or low, you want to make one high for vegetables and one low for fruits. And basically, in the high humidity drawer, you want anything that would wilt, because that is keeping that humidity in and keeping it moist, and it's allowing it to stay crisp. In the lower humidity one, that one's getting a little more airflow, and that allows some of the ripening gases to actually get out of the drawer so that they don't make your food overripe. So in those drawers, you'd want to keep things like apples, avocados once they're ripe, peaches and pears once they're ripe, and other things that kind of tend to ripen.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you say ripening gases, are you talking about gases like, you know, you hear about the apples are gassed in order to make them ripen? Is that what you're talking about?
Well, apples and other fruits, they release a natural gas that's called ethylene. And what's kind of interesting about ethylene is that it's released when a product ripens. It also causes anything around it to ripen more. So you may have heard a trick that if you want your bananas to ripen, put them in a bag with an apple. And so what you're describing, you know, in sort of the industrial food system, when they ship apples, they will tend to, or bananas, actually, they do this a lot. They'll sort of stop the ripening, and then when they want it to start again, they'll spray them with ethylene. But it's actually a natural gas, and so the natural process going on in your kitchen is that it's releasing that ethylene, and you want to get it out of your crisper drawer so that those products can breathe and not get overripe too quickly.
Right, right. Well, that's really smart. I never even realized that you had separate controls for the two sides.
Well, and not everyone does. You know, in my fridge, I don't. So what I do is I close one all the way, and I keep one just to crack open.
Uh-huh. Right, right. So interesting. Dana, we're going to take a couple minute break, and when we come back, I want to just, you know, hear some of the other tips that you have in your book. It's just filled with so many great, great things that I never even knew about. So everyone listening, don't go anywhere. I'm talking with Dana Gunders from the Natural Resource Defense Council. You're listening to Bhavani at I Eat Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I'm here today with my guest, Dana Gunders, from the Natural Resources Defense Council. And we are talking about her new book, The Kitchen Waste Handbook. Dana, you back with me?
I am.
Great. So you talk a lot in your book about how to shop your fridge and use leftovers up to make different meals. We talked about that just a little bit. Do you have any other suggestions in how to use some of the things in your fridge up?
Sure. Well, there's leftovers, and then there's kind of those products that just tend to go bad in our fridge, that are kind of extra, I would say, maybe not a prepared leftovers.
My husband sometimes makes condiment sandwiches. All those jars in the back of the refrigerator.
Right. I don't know if I could recommend that in good confidence, but you know, some of the recipes that I include in the book are focused on some of the things that have gone, you know, I seem to always wind up with extra or going bad, like avocados. I love avocados, and they're so expensive, and then somehow I get them home, and I'm waiting for them to be at that perfect ripeness, and then I miss it, and then they're overripe.
Especially when you buy those bags, where right. You have four in one bag.
Exactly. So one of the recipes, and I don't think they taste very good, overripe avocados and guacamole. Personally, I think you can kind of taste that taste of them. So I like a recipe that I included in the book to make chocolate avocado mousse. And it may sound strange, but actually the avocado takes the place of the cream and butter that would normally go into a chocolate mousse, so it's healthier, and it's absolutely delicious. I've been making it in some of my, you know, book tour demonstrations, and I give it out, and I don't tell people there's like brown avocado in it. And they taste it, and they think it's delicious, and then I show them what's in it, and they go, oh, my God, I just ate that? But, you know, you just add some cocoa powder and vanilla, a little bit of milk, and maple syrup, and it turns into a delicious chocolate mousse. So that's one recipe we have in there. Another one is for gazpacho, because gazpacho is a great way to use up all sorts of things in your fridge. A lot of gazpacho recipes have stale bread in them, so you just kind of soak the stale bread and can put that in. I also use it to use up, like, either pasta sauce or salsa or any of those tomato-based products that I find I have extra of a lot. And you can put those in with some fresh tomatoes and some herbs and some olive oil, and it usually comes out pretty well.
Mm-hmm. You know, I find using the freezer is really something that saves food for me a lot, especially, and also I actually use the freezer not only for leftovers, but I intentionally use the freezer. Things like making brown rice that would add 40 minutes to a weekday meal, and I don't want to have that 40 minutes. I know that when I'm making brown rice, I always make a double portion. I put half in the freezer so that the next time I want to make, be able to whip up dinner quickly, whether it's, you know, a few days later or the next week, I can pull that brown rice out in the morning and it will be ready for me when I come back at the end of the day to cook up. How do you recommend people use the freezer to save on waste?
You're absolutely right. You know, I think we vastly underutilize our freezers. If I were going to design the refrigerator of the future, I would have it be like 3/4 freezer and 1/4 refrigerator instead of the other way around. And, you know, I think we can use it for all sorts of things. So, as you mentioned, freezing leftovers is a great way to, you know, not have to eat them all and get sick of them during the same week. It's a great way to push the pause button on food that you may not get around to eating in time. Even for things we don't often think about freezing, like milk, for instance, and bread. If you're going away for the weekend, you can just pop your milk in the freezer and then take it out when you come back and you'll have it, you're ready to go on Monday morning for your coffee. But we often don't think about freezing milk. Similarly, bread, if you remember to, you know, I mean, like that fresh bakery bread, a lot of times you'll buy it, you'll have a few slices, and then you have this other half a loaf you don't know what to do with. If you slice it up in advance and put it in the freezer, you can actually just take a slice straight out of the freezer and toast it directly, and you can sort of have that fresh bread all week. So that's another way. And then the last thing I'd say is that I have tended, as I've become more of a more, you know, as I try to waste less food in my own life, I use a lot more frozen vegetables, and that kind of allows me to not have to feel like I'm buying buy a ton of vegetables at the beginning of the week and then get stressed out about using them at the end of the week. I tend to buy fewer. If I have a chance to get to the store in the middle of the week, then I eat more fresh vegetables. But if not, I know that I have some greens, you know, some spinach and broccoli in my freezer that I can use and still be getting those nutrients. And actually, some of those products have more nutrients than the fresh product we get in the store because they're frozen within 4 hours of harvest instead of spending, you know, 4 or 5 days trying to get to the store and then back to our homes.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's what was my next question, whether you thought they had the same nutritional value. That's interesting. And what about milk? You think it's okay to freeze milk in the, you know, carton that it comes in?
Yeah, I mean, it is. If the carton is, you know, I think milk is best frozen for short periods of time, particularly in the carton with all the air that's along with the carton. It could actually, gosh, could it potentially get freezer burned, I think? Because often freezer burn comes from exposure to the air in the freezer. So, but if you're just going away for a weekend, there's not so much chance of that. So just throw it in there, take it out. That's fine. If it's going to be in there for longer, you might want to put it in more of an airtight container.
Right. In your book, you also talk about some household uses for food scraps. Can you share that with us?
Sure. This is a fun part of the book to write because I certainly didn't know these things. And the idea behind it was, well, all right, sometimes, you know, we might eat the banana, but there's always going to be the banana peel. And are there fun, creative ways we can use that material as well? And so I was hoping to inspire people to kind of think about that. You know, avocado skins you can actually use as like a little mini serving platter for a dip. If you do make guacamole or some other dip, you can put it back in the little avocado skin and serve with it. Banana peels actually can be used to shine shoes. And it actually works pretty well. You just take the banana peel and scrub your shoes with it. It gives it a little shine. It's not as good as going to the guy in the airport, but it does work. Coffee grounds can be used to actually make a facial scrub. And avocado, you know, another thing to do with the skin, because it still has a little bit of avocado on it, can actually be used as a facial moisturizer. And that works pretty well.
Uh-huh. Do you have any advice for consumers who want to waste less but maybe feeling overwhelmed about how to get started?
I do, yeah. I think, you know, some of the easiest things to do really don't take a whole lot of time. The first, as we talked about, is just understanding the dates on food. You know, it doesn't take any extra time. But if you are someone who has typically thrown food out on those dates, I would just remind you that they really are not meant to tell you that the food is bad. They can often be eaten after that. And if that makes you uncomfortable, well, just try it, you know, a day or two after the date first and see how that goes for you. Mm-hmm. Another, as we talked about, freezing food. It's so easy to just pop things in the freezer and doesn't take much time at all. And then lastly, as we also already talked about, just being a little bit more careful when you're shopping and making sure you really have the time that week to eat that food.
Mm-hmm. I also do things with bread, especially, you know, I make my own breadcrumbs, my own croutons. You know, those are great things to do with bread that's going stale, because I'm one of those that, you know, I'll buy a loaf for a party and, you know, people are eating so much less bread, but you want to have it for those that want it. And then with the leftovers, I just, you know, I let it get stale. I, slice it up and then I grind it down for the breadcrumbs, or I cut it into squares for croutons and bake those in the oven.
And you can store those breadcrumbs in the freezer, and it'll keep them fresher.
Right, right. I was so surprised to find out how much more waste we create than other parts of the world. Like an average consumer, I think you said in Southeast Asia, we waste 10 times more than the average person. Was that across the board, like around the world, we waste more than most countries?
Yeah, we do waste more than most countries. You know, it's not quite as dramatic a comparison when you look at Europe or other developed countries. And it does, you know, not surprisingly, kind of go along income lines. So in the U.S., food is a smaller portion of our budget than almost any other country. And therefore, it doesn't, you know, it's not as strong. There's not as strong an incentive to be careful in not wasting it. You go to some of those other countries like Southeast Asia, and in those countries, the food is a much bigger portion of their budget, and so they are much more careful to make sure it's all going to good use.
Mm-hmm. I think also we touched on this at the very beginning. We waste a lot of food because we want things to look a certain way. Like when we go to the store, I know right now, you know, I have fruit trees. Now my apples always have little holes in them from a worm or a bug or something. Or my peaches, you know, one side is bruised and the other side's beautiful. And my pears, you know, and I have all these things. And because I grow it, I know that it's still fresh and it's good. And I just cut off the bad part and I use the good part. But if I was going to the store, I wouldn't want to buy a piece of fruit that looked like that, you know, if I had my choice. So I know there's a movement now to, like, for ugly fruit, to even buy ugly fruit. Do you know about any of those movements?
Yeah, sure I do. And it's absolutely true. I think any of us who garden or do have fruit trees around know that it's really hard to grow something that looks as perfect as they all seem to turn out in the store. And so you can imagine that not all fruits and veggies grow that way, and that some are getting left behind on the way to the store so that they can all look so similar and straight or round or red or orange or whatever it is.
Right.
And it really varies. It varies by product quite a bit, but nonetheless, there is quite a significant portion of fruits and vegetables that really never make it to the store because of the way they look. And so the movement that's gotten started around ugly fruits and veg, you know, they seem to have had a lot of fun with it, because you can find examples of really oddly shaped products that are kind of fun, and they've taken twisty carrots that look like a woman crossing her legs sitting up,
or right.
Personified them. There's also kind of an in between where you'll have, you know, a carrot that may not look like a woman, but it might be just a little bit bent. And those are the things that they're just not making it to our stores. And the more aptitude we show for buying those types of products, the more we'll start to see them. There's a little bit of a chicken and egg. It's hard to go into your grocery store and buy something that's not there yet. But I think, you know, farmers markets are playing a big role in demonstrating that consumers have a higher tolerance for cosmetic imperfections than the stores really give us credit for.
Right. I think also in a lot of the European countries, they have a tradition of, you know, stopping at the market on their way home and like shopping almost daily, you know, like what am I going to make tonight for dinner, and going to the market, where we're so used to like the big box stores, or, you know, buying in bulk and buying, you know, like doing our grocery shopping one day a week. It's a very different cultural thing. And I think that adds to the food waste problem as well.
That's true. And actually, the nice thing about shopping more often is that it also makes for fresher meals and fresher food, better quality. So, you know, depending on your situation, certainly in New York, there I'm sure are opportunities to buy food more often and in smaller trips and smaller quantities. Some people live in rural areas and have to travel much further, and it's harder for them. But I think where it's available, it allows you to, you know, have fresher food, cook what you're in the mood for a little bit more often instead of what you thought you'd be in the mood for 4 days earlier. And it's just kind of a nice rhythm to get into, along with wasting less.
Right. Now, does the book also get into, you know, what food waste looks like around the world? Because I know we're mostly talking about food waste on a consumer level. And I think in the U.S., that's probably the bulk of the food waste, even though we certainly still have food waste on the farms and problems with distribution. But I think in developing countries, and please correct me if I'm mistaken, but I think in developing countries, very often it's more about distribution and getting it out there.
Right. Yep. So kind of to oversimplify a little, you can say that in developed countries, it does wind up being more on the consumer end because we are so efficient at getting our food to market. Whereas in developing countries, you know, they don't always have the infrastructure to store food or transport it in the right conditions. And so a lot of it gets lost along the way. Unfortunately, as we were just talking about here, we do have stuff that goes to waste earlier in the supply chain, but it's more because we decided it wasn't good enough rather than not having the technology to get it there.
Right. I think we also have the situation in markets. You know, I've seen this where, you know, you have a bag of oranges and one orange in the bottom of the bag is getting moldy, so they just throw the whole bag out, rather than opening it up and salvaging the 9 other oranges that are still good and selling them, you know, at a discount individually to people, for instance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there are a lot of examples of sort of small moves that can be made in grocery stores and also in restaurants that can really lead to less waste in those institutions. Of course, I think they're also in a tricky position because they're trying to meet our expectations, to satisfy their consumers, and that means that they have to carry inventories. And restaurants, for instance, feel a lot of pressure to serve big portions, and because people feel like they get a better value when they get more quantity, and oftentimes they don't need it all.
Oh, yeah. The charts you have in your book about the portion sizes and how they've changed from the 1970s to now is just amazing. I mean, I've known that, but it was just, you know, a great chart to just really clearly see how, you know, even a slice of pizza, you know, it's almost twice as large as it used to be.
I know. It's wild. And my favorite statistic there is that the average cookie has quadrupled in calories since the 1980s, which sounds ridiculous. But then if you think back and remember, you know, a bake sale in the 80s, and think about the size of those cookies compared to what they sell in Starbucks nowadays, it makes sense.
Right, right.
And there's only two things that are really happening with those extra calories. Either we're eating them, and that's not good for other reasons, or we're not, and they're going to waste.
Right, right, absolutely. What other, what's your favorite part of the book that you want to share with us before we run out of time?
You know, my favorite part is the directory in the back. There's 85 common foods in there that, and for each one, you know, we talk about how the food should be stored. Does it go in the refrigerator? About how long it lasts? How can you freeze it? And, you know, can you eat the green part on strawberries or the skins on squash? And it was so fun to learn about food that way, because I came at this from a policy angle and really just feeling like there was a problem in this country with wasting so much food. But in order to write this book, I had to do a lot of research and really learn about specific foods, because I felt like that was the information that people were really missing. And so I really learned a lot. I learned that cheese is best kept in wax paper, because when it's kept in plastic wrap, that actually keeps moisture in and encourages mold. And that nuts are supposed to go in the refrigerator because they do have oils in them, and it keeps the oils from getting rancid. And I never realized that actually I've been keeping walnuts in my pantry this whole time, and I've actually been eating slightly rancid walnuts my whole life. And that, you know, keeping them in the fridge, they actually taste much fresher. So a lot of little tips like that.
Right. And also the leaves of broccoli, you know, I've been using them, they taste, you know, much more like broccoli rabe, or they're sweeter than kale. And, you know, traditionally people would buy a broccoli and the leaves instantly are pulled off and are put into the trash. And, you know, broccoli leaves are great to use too. So there's a lot of great parts of vegetables, I think, that we throw out sometimes that are, you know, broccoli stems also, you know, they're great to use. Just cut off the outer skin, which is tough. And then the inside part was my kid's favorite part.
Yep. My niece will only eat the stem. She won't eat the flower.
Right. Kids are so funny. So is there anything you'd like to share before we say goodbye? Because we're just about out of time.
Well, I guess, you know, I would just point out for all of your listeners that you spend a lot of time thinking about organic food or sustainable food and fresh food and good quality food and how do we make the best meals, and all of that, you know, is wasted if we don't actually get around to eating the food. So that's kind of, we're out to have us eat and enjoy food to its fullest, and also kind of reduce the footprint on the world of doing that. And I think being really efficient with our food by not wasting it is one of the best ways to do that.
Well, thank you so much, Dana, for joining me. And thank you so much for the work you're doing. That's so important. And for the Natural Resource Defense Council, where you work, they're just a great organization. So thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. And everybody out there, thank you for joining us. You've been listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. Be with you again next week. Bye for now.